Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is back in session, and we have a guest. I was a bonus episode. Guy we haven't talked to in a while. I'm looking forward to hearing from him again. Mike Wood Jr. is on the phone with us from Arizona. I'm assuming Arizona. Is that right, Mike?
Of course.
Okay.
I'm not leaving this safety at this moment.
So welcome back. Steve's got us all Zoomed together. And obviously we're going to talk about current events, because it's been a pretty wild time, and Mike, you've been talking about changing the structure of policing for years, and for that reason, obviously, we're really excited to have you on.
Go ahead. Sorry, Mike.
No, I'm fine. It's your guy's show. You can lead everything. But of course, I've been saying the same things for a while. The core issue isn't going to change. I think over the last 3 to 4 years, the culture surrounding police reform has dramatically changed, and for the worse. But we can go over what the core is, or we can go over George Floyd first, whichever one you'd like.
I want to start with George Floyd. And mostly because, you know, your experience as a police officer, I mean, for people who don't know, Mike was a police officer in Baltimore for how long, Mike?
11 years.
Yeah, 11 years.
And, you know, so you, and you weren't just, a patrolman or sitting behind the desk. I mean, you have, you know, various accolades as a police officer. And so, you know, from your perspective, you know, putting on your police glasses, you know, you've seen the video of what happened to George Floyd. I mean, we can all look at it and clearly see that, you know, putting your knee on a guy's neck for an extended period of time, 8, 9, 10 minutes, isn't right. But can you just take us through what you saw and kind of how you looked at it?
So I guess coincidentally would be the right word. This is the same thing that my theory is when it comes to how Freddie Gray was killed. This thing where an officer puts their knee right on that specific location of the neck and kind of like drops it down as like a pinning technique. It's so common that it's like, I think it's, the cops aren't even thinking about that they're doing it. I think with Freddie Gray, they dropped that knee on the back of his neck, and that's what severed his spine. And here, they're just using it as the pinning technique. And why they're doing it, I don't know. Most people know that you're not supposed to do that. But it's hard to assume that when we know that police departments aren't training people properly. It gets really tough when you hear the pleas of George Floyd and you understand that sound and that he may understand what's happening right there, but it's hard to say that the cop understands what's happening right there because of whom we're hiring to do policing and the overall societal ideal that police are violence. They're the state monopoly on violence, and we kind of all have agreed to that and really go along with it.
So here's the deal. I mean, you know, Derek Chauvin he wasn't a rookie cop. He has, you know, over 18 incidents or complaints filed against him.
Yeah. Think about this. I have zero.
Right. I mean, like, you were a cop for 11 years. but he's got 18, over the course of his career. I think he shot a young kid at one point, and I believe the kid died. So it's not like he was new to the force and he just did this and you know, thought that it was the right thing. I mean, this is a seasoned veteran.
Right, and it's been accepted this entire time. So it's like it's an entire system collapse. It's everyone that has passed him through is responsible for this. The citizens of that community that have been allowing their police to do this that long, I'm sorry, you're also responsible. This one thing that makes me sick about Baltimore is, like, as much as we want to talk about it, they have a lot to blame for this as being barriers to anything improving, because people are still thinking not to reformulate what policing is, but to be the ones who are in control of that power. So it's not necessarily that Chauvin is doing this thing at that moment, because the whole system's been teaching them that. It's the idea that we are continuing to have a power structure that goes doesn't go after causes of crime. It goes after these, like, subjective violation things. And whenever somebody makes a minor violation and police is our answer, we have decided, again, as I always say, that they either will die or they will comply. So, like, he wasn't complying. He died. That is literally what we have agreed upon as a community, as a nation.
Now, some people will you know, argue with you that, you know, how can you say he wasn't complying based on what we saw? It looked like he wasn't doing anything violent. He didn't have a weapon. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, your view of what compliance is, either as a police officer or just from your studies?
Well, it appears that with him, he was passive resistant. So, which means he just wasn't cooperating. It doesn't mean you have to be a threat. It means you're not complying. So he obviously wasn't complying. He was passively resisting and wasn't cooperating. So everybody got a little rough with him, because police don't even think about how long is this going to take or doing the right thing, because they're graded on how many arrests they get. So the faster they get this job over with, the faster they can move on to the next thing. But the big picture behind that is these communities are the ones who want policing to be this way. We have this because a loud voice comes out on the internet. We think that's the actual voice of the community. The voice of those neoliberal activists in Baltimore who get the spotlight are the very same neoliberals that Malcolm X warned us of. Yep. He said they would corrupt this thing, and they fucking have. It doesn't matter that they're black faces. They're still the same people from the county that go into the city and cause these problems. The people in the city want drug dealers off the streets. The calls that I handled were often black people with black politicians serving a black need to get their streets cleaned up. Yes, they misunderstood in this bigger picture that I would argue is a misunderstanding that violence of policing doesn't solve this problem. But that's the common understanding that people have, is that the police will gain the state authority, and then they will regulate the neighborhood, and then people will be safe. And to a certain extent, it's true. If safety is your priority over liberty, yeah, of course, that's logical.
You know, my experience, you know, I spent a lot of time working in Baltimore, and I can preach to that from my aspect. Like, you know, I was developing affordable housing, and, you know, there was a program that came through HUD called RAD. It's the Rental Assistance Demonstration. And what it allowed is for private money to be used to make capital improvements on affordable housing and, you know, like, state, county, municipal-owned housing, so your housing projects that are run by the housing authority. And, you know, those same, you know, black thought leaders that you're talking about who would make the calls to you to clean up the drug dealers, they would come, you know, they would push back against us in terms of what we were doing and saying, well, you know, if you're bringing in private banks, then they're going to jack up rents, and they're going to, you know, gentrify the neighborhood, and they're going to push all the, you know, lower income people out. When the program specifically, you can read it, it, you know, we couldn't raise rents, we couldn't kick people out. Like, those are rules that were set in place, and no matter how many times we explained it to them, they weren't listening. And ultimately it came down to, they didn't like the idea of someone new coming into power and having control over this situation that they had in a space that they had dominated for so long, right? The same people who said they didn't want us are the same people who would go to the media over leaking roofs and rats and the drug problems that existed in, you know, the housing projects in Baltimore and, you know, pretty much any other city.
Yeah, I mean, and you see it in every aspect. It's like it's so systemic. I mean, Chicago and Baltimore are like the examples we always go to, right? Yeah. But most people don't understand Chicago is the windy city. It's called that because its politics are in the wind. It's all because of money. And it doesn't have anything to do with it actually being windy. It means it's so corrupt that it's just blowing everywhere and everything. And that is the same thing in Baltimore. It's these old entrenched things that don't actually believe in the things that they say they believe in. They really believe in just having power and maintaining power over these communities, and no one else is allowed to come in. A media kind of thing is created, and they get like a good, it's like the version of the good old boys club. It's the black good old boys club in politics and in who gets the microphone. And I don't know how we get around that. And I really think we can see a systemic problem. Like obviously a supervisor should have been there with George Floyd. We should have had medics there faster. They should have had better training. All this stuff is obvious, but it will keep repeating over and over because nobody's going to change it. And I really think that these protests are the death knell in police reform.
So, you know, I do want to point out that, and that what you're saying is the system itself is broken. And even the people who say they want to reform it have a part in that broken system because their thought process is focused on accumulating power, right?
It's just having the police work for them,
right? And so, I think a prime example of that, going back to Baltimore, is the mayor, Catherine Pugh, who was just recently sentenced to jail. Right? Why did she go to jail? Because you know she was trying to make a school sell her books so she could make money. Right. I mean, she was a black woman and she got touted as this, you know, reformer. She was going to come in and change things. She was going to change the police. She was going to reduce crime.
She's leading for the election.
Right. Right. What's that?
She's leading for the election now.
She's
out of jail. She's leading for the mayoral election.
Oh, dear sweet Lord. I didn't know
that. This is what I mean. Like, I have nowhere to go.
that's insane. And I worked with the woman and I mean, I will tell her to her face that she was, she was just an abomination to public service. But, so I just want to reiterate that you're not attacking black people and saying black people are a problem. But what you're saying is that, you know, power ultimately ends up corrupting people. And that's
also the narrative isn't black people. It's not. It's the neoliberal accepted faces that can go on there and say, oh, black men are weak. I'm sorry, man. I spent my life on the street. Black men are not fucking weak. It's people who collapse under the system around them. That is not the message of the street. So when I hear that message, it drives me bananas when I hear the black community, especially one like Baltimore, being presented as a victim. They have challenges ahead of them, but they're all out there ready to do that. It's not the capitalist on the street corner trying to make some money to feed his family that's out here rioting. It's not. It's people from other places. It's half white people from the county that have corrupted the entire movement, just like it happened before. We're rehashing an old battle that Martin Luther King and Malcolm X had. And it's coming in the same philosophy, but what happened this time is there a choice was made. There was always this floating choice, community or chaos. That was Martin Luther King's, one of his last questions. Where do we go from here after these riots and after these protests? Do we create a community or does it just become chaos? But this time chaos was chosen. And I think once that happens, even cities like Baltimore, the real black community wants to say no. They'll say the same thing. Bring in the National Guard. Get these people out of here because insurance rates goes up. It's their stores that they can't go to. When the CVS burned in Baltimore, as much as I understood that, there was now hundreds of people that needed prescriptions that weren't going to be able to get them. And that was their only choice. And that is over and over. These are black businesses that are being burnt up. These are black children that are being burnt up in houses. That just happened in Richmond last night. A young black child like yours in a regular old neighborhood burnt up because these fools set fire to it. This is the wrong choice because now the vast, vast majority are going to agree on policing as violence, and it's going to take a long time to get back to here.
I mean, I guess the question is, though, I mean, there are people, you're seeing more people that are still advocating for change, and I get what you're saying. You know, people do want the rioting and the looting to stop, and people are calling for an end to it. And, you know, I think it's interesting that there's so many people accepting of the National Guard coming in, and yet, you know, you had people that were protesting against not being able to go to a hair salon and everything else a few weeks ago. And yet none of those people are now upset with the National Guard coming in. But, you know, I think that there's a chance. I think that I feel the opposite of you. I feel that maybe while, yes, we have the looting and the rioting, and that's really the wrong answer. If you look at who's doing it, it's a small percentage of the people that were out protesting. And I believe that there are some bad actors that came in from out of town, a lot of them. But at the same time, I think there are also some people that were taking advantage of the situation. But they're only a small percentage of that group. And a majority of people want to figure out a solution to the problem. And we've been through this so many times before. And this is so bad. It's happening across the country. You don't feel that there's an opportunity there for the changes you're talking about to be made, for people to come to the table and say, okay, we have to address this. We can't. The answer isn't more police. The answer is better policing.
No, fear is going to win. Not at all. Right now, everyone wants police and armed soldiers to sit there and defend them, because your buildings and your, just because it happened, all these people, there are, go out there and look on the internet, everyone. There are tons of examples of people who were out there saying, yeah, I understand this protest, stand up for George Floyd. And the next thing they know, they're sitting there saying, this has got to end. We got to get these people out of here. There was even a basketball player that was doing it. Because it's all fine when it's not in your neighborhood, but there's a reason you guys have guns in your houses. And when they come to your neighborhood, you're going to make a stand like all these other people do. You can't be there to protect everyone all the time. And if it's going to be who is the bigger force, people are going to side with the government to be the bigger force. It will be democracy in action. This is what happens over and over again. You must win your wars through ideas. It's not going to come through violence. Passive resistance, yes, but this active resistance will cause everyone to side on the government, crack it down, and then I think this is over, because we weren't winning the argument to begin with. Now I have no idea how I could win an argument when the rioters are destroying Black communities more than the police could even attempt to.
Mike, I
long-standing issues like insurance rates, food. Why will you have a food desert in the hood now? Because Safeway isn't fucking going there.
So Mike, you and I are probably not going to agree on who the agitators are. I've claimed for a long time, but I think Antifa is largely a right-wing plant.
Right-wing plant, you're out of your mind. They're left-wing, entrenched, long-standing since going back to Russia. I mean, they have a history going over 100 years, and they follow this insane doctrine. They're not right-wing plants.
That's okay. I disagree with you. I think there's been some evidence to back up my side. I've got right now is anecdotal, but there's been traced back to social media accounts and other people who were inciting violence, who were white supremacists.
Police departments are just fools.
That's not what I said.
Well, it would have to be. Antifa is going to be declared a terrorist organization. They are a terrorist organization. I've been saying this for a long time. But they're not. The idea that Trump is calling them a terrorist organization and they're a right-wing plant would not coincide with any narrative that I can make sense of.
Okay, well, I've seen multiple things. Again, everything I've got is anecdotal. Well,
I don't want us to really reach hard to justify the actions of rioters and go really far the other way to try and make up situations about the who we think is the other side.
Okay, well, I'm not going to say it's monolithic either. I think we could both be right in specific instances, but I can easily point to who benefits from this being the hardcore right. Blame the victims. Blame the blacks in the city, and
I just blamed white Antifa members and white acting black people who come in. And I'm not. This
isn't I don't know. That was not directed at you. I'm speaking in generalizations.
I guess I haven't heard anyone make that argument.
Well, now you have.
You know, I mean, I think whether Antifa is, you know, Jim's theory of right wing plants, and I've I. I've disagreed with that. You know, like Jim and I have gone back and forth on that. I mean, I think if you want to make an argument that, you know, that a lot of the people that claim to be Antifa now are people that were in the Occupy movement that moved, you know, further left to the point where they decided that they were going to be the strong arm of the progressive left. And then it, you know, they've just completely lost their way and have been bastardized. And now it's just wherever we go, we're going to create chaos and that'll help solve the problem. You know, I can go along with that. I don't necessarily think that, you know, Dom, what's that?
That's what it is. I mean,
right. Yeah. I mean, I think you're giving Republicans and the MAGA crowd too much credit for saying, all right, we're going to send in, you know, these white guys or, you know, you have these splinter cells of conservatives that say that they're going to set things off and then, you know, watch everything burn. And then, you know, everything gets blamed on them. Like, that's a great conspiracy theory. But I think if you look at what Antifa is, you know, it's a lot of people that came from the Occupy movement who sat on lawns and got a lot of news and media for, you know, doing sit-ins or whatever against the financial industry. And then their media pub died. And then they weren't in the spotlight anymore. And they realized they didn't really impact anything. So they
I've been on the ground watching this escalation from the resistance and from Antifa. They were in Standing Rock as well. They brought weapons to what was supposed to be a peaceful movement. I don't know where they got the money to get this stuff, but there was grenade launchers, grenades, AR-15s, all this stuff that was brought up there and funded by these guys. This is something I've like seen firsthand.
Right. I mean, and I think, if you ask how it happens like, I mean, listen, there's, you know, between Reddit and, you know, all these between social media and the ability to have private chat rooms, you know, the ability to organize is easy, right? I mean, like you could easily get the word out and spread it and get a message out pretty quickly. So I don't think it needs to be a grand conspiracy theory. I mean, I think you can agree that, you know, Antifa, maybe they think that their intentions are good, but they're clearly problematic. And whatever you believe they come from, we know that people who are claiming to be Antifa are very problematic when we have these sorts of situations. And so they're a part of the problem. You also have people that are in the situation, you know, you have the kids that see broken glass, or maybe they break a glass and they go in and they steal something, not necessarily because they're not there to protest. They're there just because they see an opportunity to go in and steal something, and they don't help. Both are very small percentages, but they're of the overall picture, but they're going to get most of the attention. And what I, you know, my thing going back to it is that you're just seeing a response from people, and whether it's on social media or even in the media, when you have Rush Limbaugh, you know, making statements about how bad this situation is, that's a sign of movement, right? Rush Limbaugh is not a reasonable guy. Or a practical guy when it comes to anything race related.
Sure, but that's what I mean when I say, like, what I don't understand what this protest is. That's why I mean it's gone too far. And the idea that everything has been given, I don't understand what is being protested at all.
What do you mean by everything has been given?
So the guy was charged. And the four cops were fired. I got real issues with firing the two other cops. I don't understand how you blame them for that. So the two that you and the cop that did it, I get. But to think that the other two cops know how much force is being applied, are medical professionals, have been trained on this. You remember, cops, for the most part, are GEDs or high school diplomas that got 6 months of training, training, air quotes, in a police academy. And then we allow that situation to happen and then turn and judge against this person for what we ask them and set them up for, while taking no accountability as a community. That's why my model hasn't worked when I go around. My model is about the community taking accountability for the police department and being in charge, but they don't actually want that. They want to just put in a new politician so they have somebody to blame, because with great power becomes great responsibility, and people don't actually want this responsibility because my theory, of course, is that policing isn't actually nearly as bad as it would need to be to cause mass society to change.
I said something similar to that once a long time ago, talking to you, Mike, and you called me Peter Parker. So just know You get the Peter Parker label tonight.
I'll take it.
All right.
Michael, you did – or go ahead, Jim.
So, you know, again, we're probably going to disagree on this a lot, probably with both of you, but the people who are lighting cop cars on fire and smashing windows and AutoZone and all that, I don't think they are left-wing nut jobs who think they're doing good. I think they are purely looking to stir shit up. Now, I got to say – I do my best to put myself in the mindset of the people involved. If I was a police officer in downtown Cleveland right now, I would be very scared. I mean, I'm outnumbered by a lot, and you really don't have control about what's going on around you. I understand why they're on edge, and I understand how frustrating it must be to be paying for the sins of someone else. I mean, if someone else did something horrible, and I think what was done to George Floyd was one of the most awful things I've seen in my years of talking about this stuff on a podcast, but for the good cops out there, it sucks.
Like any other video.
What's that?
It's like any other video. We've seen this 100 times.
But the reason that
when they don't, you know, this happens to white people all the time. You won't see it. I've seen it on camera. I've watched it. Like this is normal.
Kneeling on someone's neck for 8 minutes, if that's normal, well, then I need to move to Canada.
It killed Freddie Gray, and nothing has changed in those 4 years. This is normal policing that the vast majority agree with, because the people in the neighborhood know that that person whose neck on is a little shithead that causes them problems. The community knows that, and they don't care.
And so, I guess, Jim, back to the point, though, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we can argue about who Antifa is or who's setting the car on fire, but the issue is that it's happening.
Right
now, the argument is, well, because that's happening, and Mike, I feel like you're saying this to a degree, that because that's happening, it's delegitimizing the entire movement and the rest of the protest. And so because of it, everything is going to get shut down, and then we're going to shift back to giving the power back to the police and using the National Guard to back them up or take over. And then once everything calms down, everybody goes back to, you know, they get back in their comfort zone, and this whole thing loses momentum. And
one step further, Steve. Every time this happens, the police gain in their militarization. It grows. And this all started with in LA, and then it started with the Hollywood shootout. And ever since then, we continually militarize and use more SWAT, more force. This is a known pattern. That's all I want to say. It's a known pattern.
So here's my question, Mike. You've written a number of different things, articles, books, crime and punishments. You're officially a doctor now, right?
Yes, sir.
So
congratulations.
You have dissertations and pieces on this. For people who haven't read it, you don't have to go into all every nut and bolt, but if you maybe explain more what you mean by a community taking control of the police, right? And what the difference is between what you're saying, where they want power and a politician and a figurehead to control the situation. Explain how you mean to literally for a community to take control of the police.
Right. So first, we do have to separate how you do it and what needs to be done. So what I can say what needs to be done, and it's not what needs to be done, it is that all the other ideas I've seen thus prevented so far has failed. This one has not failed yet and is backed by science. It could certainly fail as well. I got to be open about that. But so the idea is that under the current system of policing, the power structure, especially with 4 8-year terms, are set so that politicians being in charge of policing, even if they do have a proper theoretical connection to their community, they aren't actually incentivized to go after the causes of crimes. So police departments instead go after the symptoms of crimes, which does nothing to actually solve the crime. The solution has to be a perpetual system that has a power structure that aligns with the goal of the public and of the community. So any solutions that you're here presented under the current system, they never truly able to address the issues that need to be addressed, because the current power structure has no incentives to go that way. So politicians are able to become corrupt or benefit off of policies that appear to be tough on crime, and they go under the idea of helping the community, but they don't. They only end up helping the elites of society because this tough on crime idea just keeps the jail system going. It keeps the classes division going. And what they do is they put people into a prison system that they know doesn't work, that we know is a failure, and then they come back onto the streets. So this 4 or 8 year plan, what it actually does is it incentivizes you to put people away for a short period of time so that you, by time you climb the ladder, they come back out onto the streets and cause more crime because they're now in a worse situation than they were to begin with, which is the cycle you will easily see in Baltimore occur over and over and over again. You can watch The Wire and you can watch The Corner, which was set in the 70s, The Wire set in the 90s, and then you can watch the exact same streets do the exact same thing now because this cycle will continue to go. Another fault in the current system is that the administration and the report aspects of operations are all handled within the same agency.
Right.
You know, Mike, so, you know, and to that point, I tried to explain this to someone and I said, look, and he, the person was a police officer, and he said, listen, you know, only police can really be the ones who police us because we know what the job is. And I said, okay, but like, do we really trust like restaurants to police themselves? Or is there a reason we have like a health inspector that's completely separated from all the restaurants, right? Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, it's just like, I mean, now you can, if you have a beef with the health inspector, okay, fine. But the point is that if there's a, you know, people are getting food poisoning at a restaurant, you're not going to call that restaurant and say, hey, you guys clean this up. Yeah, totally. We got it, right? Like, you want somebody from the outside to come in and make sure they're doing all the things that they need to do. And so with the police, it's a much bigger picture we're talking about here, because we're literally talking about, like you said, either comply or die. So we're talking about people's lives and people's freedoms and their liberty. And so the idea that the people who can take that away, your life or your liberty, are the ones left to police themselves makes absolutely no sense.
Well, and like, even for pure administration to make, like, sometimes one of the greatest checks for business-wise, so people know, my PhD is in business. This is absolutely on purpose because I'm trying to understand the management of policing, not how to do policing, you know, more perfect, you know, more a more proper way of getting people into the prison system. You know, that's not really what I tried to focus on. I tried to focus on how we actually uproot the entire thing. So an example is just like, when I was acting lieutenant, I signed my own overtime receipts. That's preposterous. Yeah. You know?
Are you serious?
Right. So I was the highest ranking person there. So, and I worked overtime. So who was going to sign that I worked overtime? Me. That's nonsense. So these things go all over the agency in every type of step. So even when we go through a couple more of these divisions, even if you only got one of these things in, it would actually do a good amount of improvement just separating the central reporting and the review of reports outside of the police department would do tons. And I want to get everybody away from punishing cops. I know it makes it sound like I'm defending cops or defending bad policing, but I'm trying to get us to focus on the systems and the policies that got us to this point, because that's just how I define justice. And sure, people will do it different ways, but to me, justice is making the steps to prevent this from recurring. I don't understand how justice goes beyond that. If somebody killed my daughter, I would much rather the system change so that no one else's daughter got killed than me exacting vengeance on the person that killed her. That's just revenge. I'll never understand that as our general operating system. But even if you take it away, and we get the other people to see the policy, and you're judging the policy and not the cop, well, then you're starting to feed inputs that will change police behavior subconsciously. That's what policies do. So cops aren't racist. They do racist things. That's extremely different. And they're doing racist things because this policy steers you in that direction in the subconscious, their incentives and their disincentives. All we have to do is steer it the other damn way. It's not really rocket science. I mean, that's why a black cop, a white cop, an Asian cop, a female cop, there's no difference. They're all going to cap your ass when they're scared. So we have to change that entire idea of what policing is. It's not about who is doing it. It's really about underlying systems. And that's why I'll come off as sounding like I'm really going hard after the left when I'm trying to get on this race issue very bad or hard. As long as you're focusing on which race the cops are, you are fucking missing the point by a mile. You're not even playing the same sport. Unless you're actually racist and you think a black cop actually is different than a white cop, I was pretty sure that we were all equal. But so these kind of things really steer us in a weird direction. So we need to focus on these procedural things, such as separating it from there, such as identifying the stakeholders who are in the community. And we can get into how you get these people on the same page, which is obviously a difficult thing to do. It doesn't seem to be anyone's getting on the same page. But you should be looking at the entire community, the actual community members, not people trying to get power. People have been in the community for 10, 20 years. These are your stakeholders. These are the people who invested into your city. We're giving power of policing to the people who want to leave the city and ascend to higher political office. Bill de Blasio, or not Blasio, was it Giuliani? Which one of it was it, the New York one, that admitted that the New York Police Department was his personal army? I mean, that's how these politicians see things. Police are a tool for their political ascension. And as long as that's the case, it's all moot, every single bit of it. The main key issue is getting the power structure to the people so that then when actual different groups of people are working on it, I forget what the principle is called, but you make things and policy for all these different people and stakeholders with the idea that you don't know which group you're in. Okay, and that's Mike, how you come up with better things.
And Mike, one thing you kind of touched on a bit ago, and now that you're bringing up de Blasio, it's a perfect segue to this, because you mentioned making arrests, putting people in jail for a short period of time, getting them in the system where they're now, you know, beholden to the system. They're also being financially nickel and dimed, and sometimes not even nickels and dimes. And that money is what fuels the militarization of the police, among other things. And in de Blasio's case, the police said, we're going to stop making arrests in Central Park to punish de Blasio, because I forget what he came down on. It might have been the Eric Garner case. But they said, we're not going to make these petty arrests anymore to punish de Blasio, which is basically admitting we do these things to generate money for the city and the state. So they're admitting it's all financially driven.
And it's all politically driven. I mean, you got to remember the command staff are political appointments who serve at the pleasure of the mayor. I'm just saying, we can get into the nuances of mine, but you don't have to get into the nuances. I'm saying you just must have a system at least beginning that serves at the pleasure of the community, not at the pleasure of a politician.
Now that's been the heart of what you've been saying to Steve and I since we started talking, and I think it's absolutely right. I don't think it's possible to separate the politics and the money, because those things literally go hand in hand. But the bigger picture, I understand what you're saying, and I agree.
Yeah, sure. So all those little things. So that's what also, Steve, you were talking about. Now, how do you get this put in? Or how do you actually make these things? Well, you have to get out there and you have to go out and find what your local community's thing is. It's usually the best way is if you have referendums. Now, if you don't have referendums, that means you might have to fight for referendums. But if you have a referendum that says your city is going to separate their police department from the politicians and give it back to the citizens who, you could look at my policy and go by some of the criteria, such as that they have to be in the community, that they can't be leaving the community, that it's a voluntary pool who gets put on these boards to review it. So you have to go through qualifications to make sure that you're a critical thinker and you're not some idiot that got randomly selected like jury duty. I mean, I'm not suggesting a jury duty model for who's in charge of policing, some kind of vetting that is objective, not, if you pass the merit system, and then you'll be in the lottery pool to get there. These are community stakeholders that are in there and involved in the community. You give the power to them on a board, and this is how you separate the agency so it starts working for you. Why I think people have a real problem with that is it ends up meaning that there is no reason to protest. You would literally be protesting yourself when it comes to the police department, and you would have a seat But I think a lot of times people don't actually want that seat. They're very afraid of that seat. They instead would rather somebody else do it wrong and then blame them for that failure.
So, Mike, I guess the question is, so with your model, you know, you would have, obviously the term limits would be shorter. So, you know, 1 year, 2 years at the max, right?
Rotating, right. So yeah, each person rotate. So, that way you have a division where there's never even the same people on the board ever.
Right. Like, so, I mean, it rotates every, you know, every year, every couple of years, and yet you constantly have different people in it. So I guess the question is, you know, like, so if I start a certain initiative and then we rotate out after year one or year two, then, you know, who's to say that that initial gets kind of, that initiative gets followed up on and it gets continued, you know, and is there concern about consistency and the ability to implement anything on such a short rotation?
Yeah, you definitely can't do it fast. It's going to have to take years. I would think, I go over this in the basic model. The easiest place to find is actually on my LinkedIn page. You can just search my name on LinkedIn, and it's one of the first things there where I have the model up and all the details of it. But what was your question, Steve? I forgot.
Just the ability to, you know, to implement, you know, implementation with, you know, rotating boards.
So power structures are not going to give up power easily. So we're going to have to compromise with something like that. The mayor is going to be able to pick the first board or something like that. And then after that, it's going to rotate because the mayor is going to want to be out of there before the shit's in full implementation, right? I mean, that's how they're going to feel. They're going to want that power of being in control or feeling like they at least have that influence. So you are talking about long-term plans. But as I've got on many times over, it's a 20-year thing is the most dramatic example of what is a crime causation. That's lead poisoning. It's a 20-year delay. And so unless you're thinking of at least in 20-year goal timeframes, you're not going to get anywhere with anything. So will things possibly change after you've gone on the board? Yes, I absolutely hope they do. My model is about identifying stakeholders, putting the right stakeholders in place, and then putting them with people who have expertise, people who have experience, community members, the groups that we have already set aside in identifying the stakeholders, because each group will have representatives. And when those people make their argument, you must win the argument through the idea there in that public forum. And the best ideas, as things change, should be getting plugged in to what we're doing. We shouldn't, the idea that there's going to be a set way for each city, each type of people all around the world is never going to be the case. We're going to have to do things very differently. And stupid examples of this are like here in Arizona, you can tag a dirt bike and you can ride it on the street here. It's not a big deal. And nobody rides dirt bikes. But if you did that in Baltimore, you would have dirt bikes wreaking havoc everywhere because dirt bikes are this underground community in Baltimore. So obviously you're going to treat dirt bikes differently in Arizona than you are in Baltimore. And the idea that the policy in here would work for Baltimore doesn't make any sense. So you're going to have all these little nuances. It's just the key point of it being put into hands of the actual community. And then before an issue comes up, you're able to address it and you have somebody that you can go to. Right now, it's kind of like go to the commissioner. Well, you're not going to get to the commissioner. And if you do get to the commissioner works at the pleasure of the mayor. He's going to do absolutely whatever the mayor says to do. So it's a false sense of any kind of representation. That's why police guard government buildings when there's a riot going on. They don't guard homes. You know, they guard commercial establishments first, and then if those things are let go, then they go back to the government buildings and they guard City Hall because they work for those people. They don't work for you. So all you got to do is get it to work for you. It's really it. And it's not for me to say what that is to you. It's for me to argue with you and sit here and say, no, the data says this, and fuck your feelings. This is what is going to end up happening. But it's ultimately for you to decide and for me to serve. The idea that I even hate the idea that police and the community are supposed to be reaching some partnership. What are you talking about? There's no partnership. I'm your servant. I'm literally your servant. That's the entire purpose of this thing, is that I serve what you need to protect you and improve your community. I don't serve somebody else. But as long as we are accepting this model where they serve somebody else, I don't understand what we're bitching about. You know, so, like, nothing else is going to work.
So let me ask, Mike, you said that you don't like the fact that this gets the focus becomes how to punish the officers involved. But in the case of Chauvin, in this case, what do you think legally should happen?
Oh, well, it definitely seems like a manslaughter case. It seems like a third degree case. He's automatically fired. So this is one thing that I think is a necessary kind of way to look at it empathetically. Policing is very different in that, yes, they have a lot of power, but we gave them that power, asked them to do something, and then when it went wrong, we blamed them. And not even always when it objectively goes wrong, because we only care about outcomes. Like if they would have choked him for 7 minutes and 12 seconds and he would have been alive and there wouldn't have been a camera, none of this would have ever have transpired and nobody would ever know. So it's not even like it's just the outcome that we're looking at. We should be judging process. The process where you get into there, the thousands of other times that don't lead to a death should be viewed as just as bad, because you were threatening someone's life when that knee drops down onto their neck. That's a deadly force action. And so we should be treating all of them as a deadly force action, not just the ones that actually do result in a deadly force. But beyond that, like, he committed a crime probably, but if he hasn't been trained on this and it's not documented, I don't think you have a legal case. And I think it's really weird that we protest against the state by saying that the state now needs to do what we tell them to do and use their state power in our mob rule or our opinion at that moment, because all protests are a minority opinion. The vast majority of people just want to sit at home and mind their own goddamn business either way, black, white, indifferent, it doesn't matter. They just want to live their life and go about their ways. So if we're doing that and we are creating this environment that is always about vengeance, always about justice being revenge, it just isn't. It's like that cop that I talk about. They go through fear. You know, the human body is not made to be in this kind of condition where it's in the red and they feel like their lives are being threatened. I mean, think about in the military, it's an extremely small percentage of soldiers that are ever in conditions where their lives are truly at risk. But with a police officer, it's nearly essentially everyone is about at the same risk for getting something happening to them. So when they see how many cops have been injured in the last 4 days, I mean, it's got to be well over 100 and probably, what, 5 or 6 deaths so far. So when you see that, what mindset are you going to get into? And when the average person, not out in the counties, not that doesn't have their own small armory to defend themselves, when the average person in the city doesn't have a way to defend themselves and they see the only chance being an aggressive policing to at least restore order, that's what they're going to choose.
You know, I think your statement is accurate, but I think it can be pared down. If this had happened without cameras on it, no one outside of Minneapolis would know about it. 20 or so people would have witnessed it in person. But if this was without a camera,
But the framing of this thing, so this is why I have a lot of problem, and I don't believe the protesters that they care about policing. I just don't believe it. I don't see any evidence. And the easiest examples are this same city, what was it, 2 years ago? I can't even remember that lady's name. I wish I could remember his lady's name.
The Australian lady.
Justine Diamond.
Same city.
Or Damon.
Thing exactly backwards off a backwards situation. Nobody gave two shits. If people that protest policing against black people were protesting bad policing against white people, which is actually pretty proportionate to everybody, it's about the same, then I don't, when it comes to deadly force, I don't understand. I can't believe them. And then I can't go in to the 70, 80% of people that are that are on the side of law and order. I can't go to them and win arguments about making the police less powerful when there seems to be no logic to the aggressiveness that they're seeing from.
Well, so the one thing, Mike, I think with, with Justine Damon and her, situation, it was really tragic. you know, she was, you know, she was in a, she had heard something. She went out of her apartment and she was in an alleyway. She had called the police and she heard something and the police drove down the alley. She went to get their attention. She startled them and then the cops shot her from the passenger seat and killed her in the alleyway. And I think the difference is, and I'm not saying that this is justified, but the difference is that, you know, the cop was pretty quickly arrested and charged and then ultimately found guilty and he's in jail. And so, you know, I think that there was a sense of, you know, the justice, you know, like there's the, that idea that we're obsessed with outcomes, like you said earlier, right? Like the outcome ultimately ended up satisfying people's want, right? And so what we really should have looked at is, why is this cop so jumpy? Why is the first thing that he's doing is pulling his gun? You know, what, you know, how could we have changed that scenario so that he didn't shoot her and we don't have to go to this extreme of punishing him for, like you said, revenge or vengeance? You know, how do we address it so it doesn't happen again? And I think that that there is a disconnect there, and where you feel that there's really that this, that the level of protest and the level of violence is a death knell for police reform. I personally feel that there's a possibility, right? Like there's no guarantees, but there's a possibility, there's an opening that people are more open to the idea of reforming the, like addressing the disease as opposed to all the various symptoms that come from said disease.
Yeah, I don't have an argument with the way you're saying it, but these scenarios aren't actually different. I mean, George Lloyd's killer, I forget his name. I shouldn't even have to remember the killer's name. So it should be like
Derek Chauvin.
Yeah, so he was arrested within days and they were fired immediately. The comparisons, it would be, what else would you possibly want? I don't understand. I still don't understand that question. And if I don't understand it, I don't understand how anyone else will.
I mean, what my friends have said to me is, my Black friends have said to me is, they see another Black person being physically assaulted by the police over a petty crime. And
white people all the time.
Okay, but I mean, I would admit fully that white privilege exists. I believe you would as well. Is that fair?
I'm not arguing that. What I'm telling you is that policing doesn't give a shit.
Expand on that, please.
Well, I mean, I think what he's saying is that if you look at the numbers, right? If you look at the number of people that are killed, right? I mean, the police kill about 1,000 people a year on average, right? Give or take.
Now, countrywide.
You know, the police are also the ones reporting those numbers, so who knows? But the police kill about 1,000 people a year on average, and if you look at the number of Black people killed compared to the number of white people killed, the number is about the same. Now, there's an argument you can make about proportionality and about per capita, and there's less Black people than there are white people, and Black people are overrepresented. But if you're just looking at the flat numbers, the same number of people are killed, Black and white, roughly, by the police, right? And so
there's no evidence that cops treat people differently when it comes to deadly force. Zero.
And so I guess people's rebuttal to you, Michael, is gonna be again the disproportionality. You know, there's 35 million Black people and then there's, you know, however
right.
many 70 Talk? Million white people or whatever yeah. it might be, or I guess it'd be
200 million,
yeah. But I don't want to get bogged but down there.
It's not disproportionate. It's disproportionate against white people. And I know it sounds like, as a white person saying that, it's like, oh yeah, of course you're saying that. This is not, it's just, I'm sorry. It's the literal stats. If you go by violence, which is where everyone puts cops, and the amount of interactions, it's actually disproportionate. A cop is less likely to shoot a Black suspect, which makes sense. It goes with all other crime. The vast majority of crime, violent crime, is intrafamiliarity. It's Black on Black, white on white, Asian on Asian. There's no reason why we believe that police are an exception to that.
Okay, so what I'm trying to get to is, you have this block of numbers, right? Of 1,000 people each year,
sure.
right? And so my point for the longest time has been that number, it doesn't actually matter what the ratio and demographics are, the number is too high. Yes, there's 350 million people, and yes, there are a lot of interactions every day that happen that don't end in death. But it just seems that we're too accepting of that thousand unit number, right? And then we're also too accepting. We're just too accepting of the number, right? Like there's that, and it goes back to, you know, how are these things being investigated? How are these things being reviewed? How are they being looked at? And to try to end the argument and say, well, white people are killed, you know, they kill just as many white people as they do, or it's more proportional to white people, or whatever. Like, not to me, I don't give a shit about that aspect of it. They're just killing too many people in general, and that is what needs to be addressed.
You're right, but it discredits my argument. I can't overcome it.
What's that?
So when other people see that, when the average person is observing, I can't win the argument in these scenarios, right? So when the protesters aren't about, they're about identity politics and this victimization mentality, as long as that exists, then I won't be able to get anywhere. I mean, Martin Luther King in the civil rights movement wasn't seeing himself as a victim and then going out and lashing people. They were seeing themselves as proving a point. And there's no point to be proving here. There's literally no goal. So when there's no goal, I can't win an argument. When the question is what do they want and why, neither of those things make sense. So it makes it impossible for somebody like me to overcome the argument with politicians or regular people on the street about why things need to change, because what they see is that these people need to be stopped, just like a grandma sees the drug dealer in the corner the same way.
So
it's just about my ability to win the argument. It's not actually, I'm not right. Making factual arguments. I'm making arguments about people's perception, and the perception of policing and how people feel about police is actually, this is well documented in the literature. People care vastly more about how they feel about safety than actual safety.
And so I guess what I'm saying is I think that the conversation still has to be had. Like, you have to fight through that barrier of identity politics, which is, like, right now is just, it's everywhere, right? Like, I mean, everyone's got an identity, whether it's the, you know, aggrieved reverse racism white guy, it's the, you know, LGBT community, it's the Black LGBT community, it's the trans are different than the LGBT, it's the Black men, Black women, you know, you have Latino, Asian, Latinx, and everything else. So there's, you know, everyone has, you know, their claim in the body politic, but
is that true?
I mean, I mean, everyone
like, on the left on Twitter, but if you go out into the street here and you say Latinx to one of my neighbors,
okay, that are fair. So we're talking about but there's also right. So there's two different right. There's two different spheres. There's the world that exists in, like, basically on social media and in the world of activism, right? And you can be an activist and still be a conservative, or just be, you know, I mean, I would consider like a Laura Ingraham, like she's just a conservative activist, or a Dana Loesch or whatever. She's an activist, just pushing a different narrative than what we traditionally think of as activists, right? Like, so in that sphere, right, that's where all the identity politics exist. But, you know, for the average person, they're like, look, I'm just a guy trying to make a buck and survive, right? Like, so the question is, how do we bring in those average people, you know, that have the ability to think and get beyond the grievances and just say, all right, how do we fix the actual system? How do we resolve it? And it's yes, we have to fix policing, but it also, you could say the same thing about healthcare. You could say the same thing about housing. You could say the same thing about education. There are systemic problems that, you know, that have ties to race, but you need to fix them overall because it's a human issue, right?
Totally. But I mean, that's why I think the real solution isn't this national narrative. Is just, I think it's entirely corrupting. And somebody like me who is trying to have a more national discussion to the inverse, that's an impossible hill for me to climb. The only hill that's possible is that people like you in your own neighborhoods have to win the argument in your own neighborhoods. Like, this is my problem with Black activists. Black activists are telling white people what they need to do, and they haven't won the argument in their own fucking community. So what happens is then people like Joe Biden get into office and he puts in the crime bill, and now he's not apologizing for it. And why is he not apologizing for it? Because he was told to listen to the Black leaders. He listened to the Black leaders and he put this thing in and ended up hurting the Black community because he wasn't listening to the Black people on the streets. The Black people in these communities, and it's not just Black people, it's any poor people, but obviously there's a disproportion there that's completely factual. So when you have that classism, And the police are going after the classes, and kind of society as a whole goes after those classes, it just repeats over and over and over again until someone actually breaks the mold and is actually from those people. We are allowing, all of us are allowing people to represent us that do not represent us. That is your key issue. The police are just a symptom of that core problem.
So I think you and I are a lot closer on this than some people would think, because I want to see changes. And I know in Cleveland, we have a community review board. I actually applied for that community review board and, they didn't bring me on. And now I can't because I technically don't live in the city of Cleveland anymore. But, I fought for that, but I still have, been able to have access to the, like city leaders. And one of the big things that you talk about is like, yeah, you could talk to the commissioner, but ultimately the commissioner works for who? The mayor, for Jackson. And that's frustrating. And, a lot of this is like, and you say it's an impossible hill to climb, but I think
for me,
right, for you. And I think and what you're saying is that I have to pick up the mantle and I have to complete that climb, with other people in, the other stakeholders in my community in order to make this change happen, lose the idea of race and just talk about what the system is. And I like to make the argument at times that, listen, it's happening to, in your perception, it's happening to Black people. You, Michael, are saying that it happens to white people as well. But I think there's a conversation where there are even white people who don't believe that it happens to white people. That,
of course, yes,
there is. You know what I mean? Like, so, I mean, I think they need to be convinced that, yes. Listen, if it's happening to George Lloyd, then it could happen to you, Tim Jones, right? Like, just because, you're removing yourself, but listen, these police, that same police system operates in it's the same city, you live on a different side of town, but it's still, the police operate the same way, and it doesn't take much for them to shift and do the same thing to you that they're doing to those people, so let's fix the system so it doesn't have to happen to anyone anymore.
Exactly. I don't think any other way around it.
All right, Mike, so, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. We've been going for an hour, and I think people will get bored and stop listening to us. but I just, I appreciate you coming on. It's been a while, but I think what you have to say is important. And I think people may kind of bristle at your delivery at times.
Let's all be honest.
I think, I tried to explain it to people like this. I'm like, look, if you want to get bigger, faster, stronger, you have to work out and you have to make yourself uncomfortable, right? Like getting muscle, and you have to tear the muscle down, you have to rebuild it. And that's a painful, uncomfortable process. And so this process of changing an entire system, whether it's policing or healthcare or whatever it is going to be uncomfortable. Right, people are going to not be comfortable with it, and most of those people who are not going to be comfortable with it are going to be the people in power, right? Mm-hmm. So ultimately, we have to make them uncomfortable, and we have to push past them to make this work. Just like you have to push past your limits when you're training, and I associate a lot of things to training because that's probably the only thing that I do well. So, Mike, again, like, I appreciate you on, Jim. If you have any last words, and then we'll let Mike get the last words in.
Mike, good talking to you again. I could say a whole bunch of things. I think we didn't focus enough about the financial aspects of this, because the financial incentives to, you know, beating up on lower income communities play a huge role. And Mike, you brought up real quickly, you brought up food deserts and things like that. And that's a really tough balance, because that's a real problem that the, you know, inner city and other lower income neighborhoods struggle with. But you can also look at the point of the business owners and say, it's not in my best interest to put myself in a place where I'm not going to financially benefit. So that's a tough situation that we need to find a solution to.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the other thing we could do, I think I would like to have another conversation maybe in a month or so, just to kind of see where we're at, right? Like, so let's see what happens when the protests die down and the rioting stops and the National Guard is gone. And let's just see what the conversation is. And, you know, probably Mike will be right in terms of people will have moved past it. We'll be talking about the election. You know, this will be used as a soundbite against Donald Trump. And Donald Trump will be using it against Joe Biden, but nothing mm-hmm. will be actually happening. Or maybe legitimate conversations will be happening and you'll start to see the seeds of growth and change. I don't know, but it's probably worth it to have the conversation again. And then we can start to talk about some of those other things regarding finances. We can also start to talk about some other aspects, because I think healthcare is a major part of this. You brought up lead. You know, with me working in housing, that's one of the biggest things that I want to address, is going and, you know, tearing down some of these buildings that have been built since 1937 that are just filled with asbestos and lead and everything else that are directly impacting these kids' cognitive Yep. growth and abilities, right? I mean, so I think we can talk more about those things. And if people haven't heard us talk about them, then we can introduce them to it, or we can reintroduce them to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Lead poisoning is a huge one. The finances are a huge thing. These are all aspects that play into this without a doubt. And if anyone wants to focus on any one specific thing, then I can go ahead and easily pull some research and give a more specific narrowed focus for a specific topic.
Sure.
Well, Dr. Wood, if you want to close things out, and that's the only time I will ever call you Dr. Wood, by the way. But
you know, it's not coming off your tongue, say it.
I said it once, that's all you're getting. You can replay it once we publish this. But if you'd like to close things out, floor is yours.
Yeah, all I'd like to say is that we need to at least educate ourselves and not be so confident about what we think we know because we've experienced something anecdotally. Policing and politics and societal change are much bigger pictures. And even if it's going back and actually reading the words of King and X, the leaders who actually got something done, I think that would be extremely important. And if you want to know more about policing, my most recent study that I did, my dissertation is published, and anything can be found under this. It's all going to be under a series now called The Business of Policing. So if you just search The Business of Policing on Amazon, you can find that. And the new one is Managing Ethical Police Conduct. That was the big study I just finished. And it revealed something that I didn't think of ever. And it's that one of the key problems we have societally and transcending into policing is that we disagree over the source of ethics. About half the police commanders I interviewed in a long interview process for Academy Commanders, that half of them believe and individual ethics and the idea that we need to trust an individual officer to make the right moral decision. And about the other half of them believe in community ethics, which means the officer must view ethical, while they're working, must view moral conduct as what the community has deemed ethical. Obviously, I would side with the officer must behave as they deem ethical, but the law states individual ethics. So even if we are talking about communal ethics and our officers doing what we want them to do, the law still incentivizes and protects them to act off of the individual ethics they have. What would they do? How would they feel? Did they feel in fear? I don't give a shit how they felt. They're supposed to be serving their community. And that's the part about service, being a soldier or a cop, is that you need to be operating under communal ethics and serving your community, not acting as an individual, regardless of how moral your outcomes may be.
So just to clarify there, Mike, and I think your brain was moving a little faster than your lips, or vice versa. Yes. You believe that the officers should act based off of what the community deems ethical as opposed to what the officer's personal ethical beliefs are.
Right. So if we're talking about, let's say something simple, like when you point a gun at a suspect, I don't think that that should ever come down as policy and law does now, that the officer can point the gun at you when they feel something. Right. I don't care how you feel. You
fuck your feelings.
Right. You can only care. You can only point your gun at somebody when this condition is met. They are objectively a deadly threat. And we all know that in every other kind of thing. Like if I pull my gun out on my wife and I'm like, oh, I had to defend her and her 5'2", 100-pound self. Like, come on. That's absolutely unreasonable. There's no chance I had a fear of death. So we have to set up some kind of guidelines that are way more objective. And sometimes that means the officer's at a disadvantage. Yeah, that's what happens when you're a servant.
All right, man. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Again, Mike, we appreciate you for jumping on with us. You don't really do social media anymore. You do have a Facebook page. Is there anything you want to promote? You did talk about your studies. Is there anything else you want to throw out there?
No, all I'm trying to do is write things. So whether it's books on Amazon or wherever you want to go, or it's just reading the Medium page that I have that has a lot of articles and cites everything. I don't just write an opinion piece. I cite all the evidence and peer-reviewed evidence, not, you know, CNN.com or whatever.
Right.
I'll take those as being directed at me, and I'll own that.
As all media, I really wish.
I'm just joking, Mike. It's all good.
That all media has always been a lie. When we thought it was telling us the truth, we were being deceived. Everything that you are being presented is a mask for the elite. They are sending you a message. And if you don't keep that wall up, you're going to fall victim to a narrative that doesn't exist in reality.
All right.
Great.
Well, thanks, guys. Thank you. Thank you again. It was good talking to you. I hope the family is well, and we'll talk again soon.
Great.
Take care, Mike.